Given that it's the end of a week where there were many talks and you are probably a little exhausted, I will give this talk as a theater play rather than as a talk. Now, in the country of Tennessee Williams, it's not a streetcar named Desire, but it's a streetcar named ESS. That's the title of the play. And there are a number of characters. There is a first of all, there's a hard-nosed population geneticist who thinks that only models that include explicit genetics are good models in evolutionary biology, and that you can forget about the rest. And then there's a new wave adaptationist who knows about all these things, who knows about molecular biology, so he's not badly informed, but who thinks that each level needs its own approach, and that there are limits to reductionism. And then there are a number of other people. I don't know whether they will all be, it depends on my mood, whether you will see them all on stage, including Sewell Wright, Richard Dawkins, and a few others. And now, the play begins with reviving good old Charles Darwin, and who enters stage and said, well, I've seen you've been discussing evolutionary biology for a whole week, so tell me what's happened to my concept of evolutionary adaptation. And then he, since he's now, I mean, he took courses in the meantime, so he learned a little bit about modern biology and about mathematics and economics and all these things. And he says, I'm a little confused because, I mean, I didn't know anything about the genes. And yet I have the impression that I explained quite a bit, and that for most of last century, people explained things without explicit genetics. Although additional insight clearly was gained by looking at genetics. It's, for example, about how the genome changes and all these things. But if it's the length of the trunk of an elephant or so, nobody told me that genetics is very important to understand that, why it is not a meter longer or shorter. So he is confused. He also tells us that he went to see the Stanford group in population genetics and that he learned there that one should not do evolutionary game theory because it ignores genetics and that things go wrong as soon as one invokes genetics. And he wants us to explain this to him. And now the hard-nosed population geneticist enters stage and says, well, let me explain to you the modern concept of adaptation. And since you don't know so much about genetics, let's come up with a very simple example. And the simple example is as follows. We look at a trait that is depends only on one gene, which with two alleles, and where the highest fitness is given to the heterozygote, as it is the case, for example, in this famous disease called sickle cell anemia, at least in simple pictures of it. And if we want to understand evolutionary adaptation, we have to worry about what is it that is optimized. And now he starts teasing the adaptationist and says, look, if you went out, suppose you could identified three phenotypes that correspond to these genotypes, but you wouldn't know about the underlying genetics. Your students would do all these measurements of fitness. You would say, oh, wonderful, here I see natural selection at work, because there are three types, one of which, for example, in the case of sickle cell anemia is almost lethal, so that fitness is practically zero, one with a decent fitness and one with a slightly lower fitness. Then what your students would say is, this is a wonderful scenario for selection to work. If we go into this population and we come back a few generations later, we will see a change in the distribution of these types. If this is truly, if this is inheritable and so forth. And then a few generations later, the students of your students go and do another study and what they see is the same frequencies. Now, why is that so? Clearly because of the Mendelian rules. If these things mate, they always produce these other two types for Mendelian reasons, so you can't really get rid of them, and so forth. But you would only understand this phenomenon if you know the underlying genetics. And now Darwin asks, I have learned that nowadays people like to talk about adaptation in terms of optimization, that something is maximized or so. Now, could you tell me what the population geneticist, what kind of maximization principle the population geneticist would invoke? And at this moment, the door opens and another person enters stage, this good old Sewell Wright. And he said, but gentlemen, I told you in the 30s already how to treat these things. And he says, look, if you depict on this axis the state of your population, the genetic state of your population, which is in this sense, in this case, very simple because it's just the frequency of one of these alleles, when we have one minus that frequency is the frequency of the other allele. And if you then, using Hardy-Weinberg proportions, compute the mean, I mean, suppose that you have values for the fitness of the three genotypes, and then using Hardy-Weinberg, you compute the mean population fitness function, then you get something like this, for example. Hardy-Weinberg means that if you have random mating and you have alleles that are there in the population at frequencies P and Q, say, P is the frequency of one allele and Q is that of the other, then in a sense, when newborn offspring is produced, it's like drawing balls from an urn where these things are with these frequencies, and therefore it's very easy to compute the frequencies of the new genotypes where, for example, the AA genotype would have the frequency P square, and the BB would have Q square, and the heterozygote would have 2PQ.
Just the binomial distribution.
Yes, yeah. And so if we do this, then I have, that's what Sewell Wright would say, I and other people have shown that if you then look at the simple selection model, what you get is that if you start here, for example, that you move into the direction where fitness is increasing. If you start here, you also will move into the direction where fitness is increasing, and you will stop. There is an equilibrium underneath the peak of this fitness mountain, and this is what I call the fitness landscape. And this is an old story, and this is how optimization works. Now, the adaptationist is not very happy about this picture, for one reason, namely that the space over which this optimization takes place is somehow the genetic state of the population, whereas he is more used to thinking about individuals and what's good for their fitness and maximization at that level, and this picture is different. Also, there's another thing which may, you may be a little confused at this moment, because on Monday I was talking about frequency-dependent selection, and the main point I made was that with frequency-dependent selection you would not expect mean population fitness to increase, although it is taking place in this kind of model here. Now, the reason why it's taking place here is that we are looking at the moment at the model of frequency-independent selection. I was assuming that the three genotypes have constant fitness regardless of the distribution of phenotypes in the population, and this is why, the only reason why such a picture works. Another very big problem, but let's not talk about that for a moment. And then Darwin asks, what happens if you have more dimensions, more alleles, and the like? And well, then they tell him it's, in a sense, what you then get is a true mountain. For example, with two, if you have more alleles, three, for example, then you get a true fitness landscape with mountains and so forth. And what you can say is that the way things evolve is that the landscape acts like a Lyapunov function, that you climb up the hill, although not necessarily on the steepest ascent. So it's not. But you can artificially, I mean, the mathematicians, if they want to play with that, they can create a metric that causes the system to actually climb up the hill on the steepest ascent. But that's not something I want to focus on here, because now the people...
What was the last thing?
Oh, that you can... Oh,
the very last.
The last is that the Shashahani matrix allows you. If you just invoke a non-Euclidean matrix here that is appropriately designed, then you can get these things to actually climb on the steepest. Then you get the gradient system. So this is the old theory about fitness landscape that has become very fashionable, and now they decide to discuss things even more, and to what they are aiming at is a model where at the phenotypic level they want to describe interactions as an evolutionary game where individuals interact, play strategies, and where then their reproductive success depends on, or their survival depends, for example, on that. And they say, okay, what's behind such a model? Then if one wants to link the phenotypic world with the genetic world, one has to worry about how genotypes translate into strategies, for example. Now, we know that environment plays a role, especially when culture is involved. I mean, so usually what we assume in models in theoretical biology is that there's a function that maps genotypes into strategies, or into at least probability distributions over strategies. What's then easily forgotten is that environmental influence can also change that, and that's especially a problem when we talk about human evolution, I think. But so here they decide to, for today, for this theater play, we are not going to worry about that. We just assume there is such a function as that thing. As far as mating is concerned, they agree, today we will not worry about non-random mating, assortative mating. We don't want to talk about speciation or anything like that. We just assume random mating. We also don't want to, talking about recombination and the segregation of chromosomes, we do not want to worry about genes that mess up the Mendelian genetic system in their own favor or so. So we want to assume that the population is at the genetic level rather well behaved, following the Mendelian rules, and see what kind of adaptation principle could one find if one analyzes this process. And now they have started already with the fitness landscape, and Sewell Wright thinks he is quite happy with that, and he thinks Fisher also would agree that this is a nice picture, and many other people. And now an Australian mathematician enters the room. His name is Moran. And he says, but gentlemen, this idea of the fitness landscape is in some sense misleading, because it is simply not true that populations climb these fitness mountains, even in the case of frequency-independent selection. And I will show you why that is so. So now Darwin gets very interested in how his view of the world seems to break down a little bit. And so what does he have to learn here? What Moran comes up with is the simplest case where one sees the problem that he's addressing. It's a two-locus model for viability selection in a sexually reproducing diploid population with random mating. And but what I say here would also apply to n loci. I mean, it's not limited to the two locus case. It's just much easier to demonstrate it here. Now, so what he says is, suppose we have two genes now, A and B, and only for simplicity here, we put them on the same, for the drawings, I put them on the same chromosome, but the theory doesn't care. It could also be on different. The way you would see that is by a different. If the recombination rate is a half, that means that they are on different chromosomes. If it's a small one, it's on the same. And let us suppose that each of the genes, A and B, has a finite number of alleles, A1 to AN and B1 to BM, so that we can have all sorts of genotypes like this. And now clearly it is important that Darwin asks now, what do I have to worry about? What is fundamentally different between the first case that you showed me with sickle cell anemia, with a single gene case, and in this model here, and then we would have to tell them, okay, clearly what is fundamentally different is that now we have, and if it's on the same chromosome due to crossing over, we have recombination between the two genes. That is the additional thing that comes into play. But otherwise, we want to remain as simple as that. So let us look at the case that looks best for Darwin, namely where every genotype has a constant fitness that doesn't depend on anything, neither on density nor on frequency and so forth. And one would think that Darwinism should work well in such a simple-minded case. And but Moran says, wait a second, you will see that this is not true. Now then, the first question is how can one model natural selection in such a simple world? Then the first question one has to ask is, I mean, what is the state of such a model that is changed by selection? And think of all these alleles of gene A and the alleles of gene B. Then the genotype is then just a combination of two such alleles. And it has a frequency in the population, a relative frequency X sub ij. And so you could think of the state of the population as a frequency histogram of all these different chromosomes that differ in how gene A and gene B, in the combination of the allele for A and allele for B. Now, if you want to describe how that frequency changes from one generation to the next, I'm using here a difference equation, a set of couple of difference equations, one for each chromosome. And what you get then is that the frequency in the new generation depends on, there's one over mean population fitness here, which you get in all these equations. And then you have two ways in which this chromosome can be produced, so to speak. It can be produced because it was there in the previous generation without any recombination act taking place. And then you have to worry what is the frequency of genotypes where it occurs, and you get this formula here. But it can also be produced due to recombination where you get this term. And now then one can use this equation and actually compute selection. And by the way, the population state is, if you like, a vector that contains all these frequencies of our chromosomes. So this is the frequency histogram I was talking about. And what Moran now says is the following. I have an example that I produced long ago, actually in 1964, which looks as follows. Where I have two genes and two alleles for each gene, and the violet numbers are the fitnesses associated with the genotypes. And what you see here is that the double heterozygote has the highest fitness, and this is a bit the similarity with the previous example. The difference is that now it's the double heterozygote, where in the first case we didn't talk about it. And what happens in the system if we use these values to specify numerically the selection equation that we just saw? Something very odd happens, which looks non-Darwinian, namely that if you take the right starting condition, then fitness actually goes down and you enter your equilibrium from above. So it's not an increase of fitness that is taking place, it's a decrease of fitness that's taking place. And Moran says, isn't that annoying for Darwinists? No, there is selection acting. But we have created a scenario where the highest fitness is given to the double heterozygote, and that's the trick. Because you will see what right conditions are in a second, because I want to explain why one can see such an effect here, because what one has to think about is what would happen in such a model in the absence of any selective forces of the Darwinian kind. So if selection is neutral, and if you then start in a situation with extreme linkage disequilibrium, to use the terminology that our friend Alexei didn't like, then you can see here you have the four possible chromosomes. Here it's called A1, B1, A1. If you start with a artificially, I mean, if you start with a population where you have this chromosome here with allele A1 and allele B1, and with that chromosome with A2 and B2, and none of these two, so that is an extreme case, if you like. Now, what happens if you let this population reproduce without any Darwinian forces acting? So everybody has the same fitness. Because of crossing over, you get the emergence of these two chromosomes. And it depends on the rate of recombination. Here I assumed a rate of 0.1. So after one step you have this distribution. And if you just let this process continue in the absence of Darwinian forces, then what you end up is with what's called linkage equilibrium. Sorry?
That's unique.
Yes, yeah. But it's unique because essentially what that means is that you have that they are independently distributed, so that it does not depend on the state of gene A what the state of gene B is. I mean, this kind of independence, it's due to the reshuffling that's taking place. And so you have this process that drives you to this limiting case here on the one hand, and the Moran example is chosen in such a way that selection pushes you the other way, out of linkage equilibrium, because the highest fitness is given to the double heterozygote. And then what you end up with is something that depends, or is a mixed effect of both processes, and therefore is not exactly what you would expect on the basis of purely Darwinian considerations alone.
If you start in a state where you don't have any linkage equilibrium,
yes,
then can that fitness go down?
Oh, no. Clearly, the case where you start has to have disequilibrium, then the fitness goes down. If you start with equilibrium,
but
it goes up.
Sure.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. It's. So I mean, it's.
Similar to the case where you the quasi-species case where you start sort of with the delta function of the wild type, and then mutation simply accumulating.
Yeah. But what's annoying here is that what you get in the end as the equilibrium result is not characterized as the maximum of anything. Now that's the annoying part of it. So what in terms of the fitness landscape of Sewell, right? What it means, you do not stop underneath the peak of the hill, and you can walk, depending on where you are, you may walk down the hill. It's no longer a Lyapunov function, and that is annoying. I mean, and this is what the Stanford School made so much fuss about in the past, and why they called everybody, why they said that either you do complicated genetic models or you are not a good evolutionary biologist. And now what I'm doing in this theater play, there will be another player coming to tease the Stanford School. That's obviously that's the. Actually, the funny thing is that the Stanford School produced itself almost all the ingredients in order to kill this kind of argument, but they didn't put the picture together in a way that makes that too clear to the rest of the world. And so it was Reinhard Selten and myself who created that picture, mainly using ingredients of their own theory. It's just a different way of looking at the mathematical effects. That's Mark Feldman. I mean, the people who emphasized these problems, that was Mark Feldman and Ilan Eschel. But it was Eschel himself, I mean, who actually made most of the steps towards curing this. But then when it came to writing it down, I mean, what the cure looks like, I mean, it's not so easy to see from his work why things work better than they seem. Although I'm mainly using his ideas here.
In analogy to a mutation load, could I call this a recombination load?
Perhaps one could say that. Yeah, but we will see how much of a problem that really is. I mean, there's some problems disappear if one looks at them the right way, and that's just the aim of this. A theater play needs a happy end. it's a comedy, not a drama today. Now, let me say a few words about, because I want, after all, to talk about the genetic background of ESS theory. Now, what happens if one invokes games? Then what you have to think about is, okay, you have genotypes as before, but they don't have constant fitness. What they do is they code for a strategy, or you have this map that the phenotype specification function that either gives you a strategy or a probability distribution over strategies. And then individuals at the phenotypic level interact, play this game, and have their fitnesses changed by that. And the question is, what does the whole story, how does that relate to this more complicated picture with frequency-dependent selection? Is it of any relevance? Because we know that with frequency-dependent selection, we don't expect things to move up the hills anyway. And or at least there's no principle that one can formulate that would say that mean population fitness or anything like that is maximized, because obviously it is not in the simplest examples even. But there is something unfortunate to say that, first of all, let's look at what such a model looks like. So here we have the genetic model with game interaction at the phenotypic level. So we have a genotype here, again as before, and then we have a function, the phenotype specification function, that tells us what strategy is associated with this genotype. And this can be a probability distribution, therefore I call it a mixed strategy here. So that is called Ui sub ijkl. And now if we know the distribution of genotypes, then we automatically, with the help of this function, we know the distribution of strategies in the population, and we can compute something like the mean population strategy at time t. And the fitness of the genotype then is what you see here. It's a basic fitness. That's what the genotype would have if no game was played. It's before playing the game, your fitness expectation. And now the fitness expectation is changed because of how well you end up in the game, and then you get the expected payoff for playing your strategy in this population. And the reason why the Moran or the way in which the Moran logic applies to this two here is as follows. You can clearly create a picture. Suppose you knew what the evolutionarily stable strategy looks like, or Nash equilibria look like, and then you would create an underlying genetics such that this is only achieved by a double heterozygote, like in the previous example. Then again, the reshuffling due to recombination would destroy that state, and you would have a force counteracting the Darwinian frequency-dependent selection forces here. So once again, one can see that Moran's idea also applies to such systems. You would not end up at a Nash equilibrium necessarily, or at an ESS. And now in a theater play, one always has to make things look a little more dramatic than they are in reality. So one of the new wave adaptationist goes to bed and has a terrible nightmare that John Maynard Smith has to give a talk called The Funeral of Neo-Darwinism. And but as you may have noticed, very often after a nightmare, one has good ideas in the morning on how to rescue, how to save the problem. It looks less dramatic than usually at the moment where you wake up. And this is the case here too. So this is JBS Haldane. It's a you see, we are talking about a school here. I mean, he was his teacher, and he, by the way, was my teacher. And and he has even some, I think there are some flies in here, because believe it or not, John has actually counted whistles in his life. And so now the question is, how does one go about all this? And this is now the new wave adaptationist who now starts teasing the hard-nosed population geneticists and Moran and so forth. And it's a paradigm that I like to address as the streetcar paradigm. You will see in a moment why. It's I compare the evolving population with a streetcar, mainly for the following reason: that a streetcar has lots of temporary stops where it comes to a halt and then moves again after new passengers enter the thing. And then at some stage it comes to a final stop where it doesn't stay forever, but where it stays for much longer. That's the picture. Forget about the tracks. The tracks are disturbing the picture a bit. Now, this picture doesn't look, very as if there was anything excitingly new in it, because it looks like straightforward Darwinism. But the point will be, I mean, where it departs from the standard way in which people look at things, in how to think about these mutants that enter the streetcar. And because what's done in traditional population genetics is that people say, okay, let's have these two genes, and let's have alleles A1 to AN for gene A, and alleles B1 to BM for gene B. And then let's specify an arbitrary function that maps genotypes into phenotypes, and then look what happens, and then something crazy happens. As if that was the end of evolution. And here the idea is that one has to be very careful in what mutants not to forget about, and to actively search for what mutants could enter the system that would lead to more adaptation that one has forgotten in the first place, so to speak. Also to take those mutants into account that change something about the way in which things are coded, because there's no reason why the phenotype-genotype relationship should remain the same for millions of years, if that is in the way of adaptation. And,
outside of the theory.
Well, to make it part of this, the whole aim here is to make it part of the theory. But it's outside, I agree. I mean, in classical, in traditional population genetics, this search is outside of the theory, and that's exactly the mistake. We will see that in a moment, because let's just go one step further and then discuss, because I will also in this talk go a little bit beyond the mathematical theory that we have developed here, because there's some more biological facts that one can use that are along the same lines, although not exactly depicted in this mathematical picture. Now what we did mathematically was the following. We said, now suppose this is phenotype space here, and the population is moving in phenotype space, and that's the cause of our population. And we start with a situation here where the alleles that we have in our model to begin with are present, and we have somehow arbitrarily specified this function that maps genotypes into phenotypes. Now we let, using the equation that I showed you, where the only difference is that these constant fitness values are replaced now by the fitness functions that relate to the game. We let the population evolve. We realize that it comes to a halt. And now we ask the following question. If God gave us a new allele, AN plus 1, without loss of generality, and we could...
wait. Not in your theory.
Well,
like,
I'm not a religious person. I'm not a real. We will get rid of God in a moment. So if we could design a new allele, would it be possible And what does that mean to design a new allele here, mathematically speaking? I mean, at a very abstract level, it would mean to add something called AN plus 1, and to really specify the effects of that allele, we would have to extend the function that maps genotypes into phenotypes. We would have to, so we do not, we stick to the same phenotype set here. It's the same set of strategies of the game. We do not enlarge in the strategy set as such, but our new allele can somehow, I mean, it comes in all sorts of combinations with the other alleles in genotypes, and we have to somehow specify how these new genotypes map into strategies. So it's an extension of the phenotype specification function that we have to make in order to define our new allele mathematically, and then we can ask the following question: if we are, yeah.
AN plus 1 would have been part of your genotype space to begin with.
Not of my genotype space.
Do you really change the dimensionality now?
Yes. I get a new dimension in genotype space,
but not in
phenotype space. Yeah. It's not, because what this is not about here is about the invention of a new phenotype as such, because we suppose here that the relevant phenotypes are already in the model. And that the problem we are dealing with here is that genetics is in the way of phenotypic adaptation, although a nice ESS phenotype is already in the model in principle, but the genetic system doesn't allow evolution towards it. And, yeah. The extension we can in principle allow as I said, I mean, we allow this function to either specify an exact strategy or probability distribution over strategies, like a mixed strategy. That's.
I mean, there's not just a single possible AN plus 1 with.
Oh, no.
Make
oh. No. That's not unique. No, certainly not. And it may also, in more complicated model, depending on which you pick, it may go into different directions and you may go to different ESSs and so forth when there are alternative ESSs. Yeah? Oh, the thing is, sure, this can happen. So, for example, on the way towards this equilibrium, maybe that some of them are lost already or so, but at least we would still consider them as candidates for mutations. So they are always used again as potential mutations. And if the state is not safe against these mutations, then we would say it's definitely not a candidate for an ESS or anything like this.
Yeah.
Well, because if one looks at how one models these interactions at the phenotypic level, then it is a complicated story about how information is transformed into action, and that is in a formal mathematical sense that is what's called a strategy. It does not imply intentionality or so. So when we say strategy, it does not mean that we assume that the individual organism chooses a strategy because it thinks that's a good idea to how to behave. On the contrary, we treat them as if they were programmed robots, where the strategy is, if you like, a computer program that governs their behavior. But it's something that is more subtle than just red or blue, and not something that you can describe with one parameter or so. That's why I prefer the term strategy, because otherwise, people always think that what we are talking about is body size or things that you can describe with one or two or three parameters. And it's more a principle of how the organism uses the information in order to act. I mean, in order to, for example, in a fight, under what conditions to escalate the fight, under what conditions to stop, when to run away, when to run towards your opponent, all these things. And that's a complicated way of information processing. And it's the evolution of what evolutionary game theory tries to capture is the evolution of such information processing algorithms, if you like.
So mathematically, it's just that these strategies are independent of population state. And the Ws are this quadratic form.
The strategies depend here on the genotype, because you we have this function that maps genotypes into the strategy space. The only thing we allow here in principle is that it may not be a definite association, in the sense that maybe it's a probability distribution that the same genotype with probability a half does this, and with probability a half does that. So that some coin is flipped during ontogeny that produces this effect. So that's also permitted here in this picture. But otherwise, it's a fairly strict relation between genotypes and phenotypes. And that is problematic, as I said earlier, once you talk about human evolution, because there is a very strong environmental cultural influence. If you ask how do they then really behave, your robots, I mean, even if we consider ourselves to be robots, you have to worry about the strong cultural influence that also shapes behavior, and it's this complicated way in which genetic and cultural influences interact that give you the picture. This is why it's particularly difficult to think about human evolution, I think. But that's not the thing I want to worry here. Here it's more the worry about Mark Feldman and the like.
Yeah. Couldn't you consider the whole system as a virtually infinite system, and so that your music is already present?
Yeah. Okay. That's you're right, Ed. Yeah. It's one way of rephrasing this theory would be to say that there is a huge space of potential mutations considered to begin with. I prefer, at least in the way I think about it, I prefer the more constructive approach, where I think more instead of, I was raised as a mathematician, where you always say, here's a Banach space or whatever space, and let's, and as soon as I worked in biology, I found this approach a bit inconvenient, because it doesn't force you to deal with the real world enough. I mean, here I prefer to think in a more constructive way about what these kinds of mutants would be that one would need to include, because that allows more discussion of biological phenomena. But you are right. One could, I'm sure that one can create an abstract mathematical picture that just says let the mutant space be such and such.
To this point, the price you pay for that
is, yes,
once you're at the stop, the theoretician has to sit back and think, you know, why am I at the stop?
Sure.
And what is the appropriate n plus one I can insert to make the thing go further? There is no sort of theoretical frame that would, there's no equation from which you could calculate possible n plus ones that would make your
train. I mean, so far I let you participate in a thought experiment, and I will show you in a moment how one can come up with something positive, so to speak. Because you could say that so far my points are almost philosophical. I mean, is that really this is where normally they stop thinking in population genetics, and is there a good reason to do that? Now, clearly, it will, and I will come back to that question, whether that is a good reason to stop here or not will depend on how likely it is that one would actually find such mutants that would cause the system to move again. But let me first tell you how this theory is conceptualized, because it is not the case that for all such stops you are able to construct such an extension of the phenotype specification function, because there are cases where that is impossible. And as long as one does not allow selfish genetic elements to come into play. I mean, if it's clear that anything can be destabilized here, if a segregation distorter comes into play, that is very effective as a segregation distorter, but happens to have an effect on these strategies, so that the somewhat crazy strategy is induced at that. So in this sense, anything can be disturbed. But segregation distorters are not part of this picture, because I did assume decent Mendelian segregation. And that's what this theory is about the problems within that realm. And now you can ask the following question. Suppose your population, if that exists at all, has reached a final stop in the following sense, that in this given fixed environment, another important thing, and given that genetics is decent, I mean, no segregation distortion and the like. Suppose that it is impossible to find such a new mutant allele mathematically, that you cannot, that it's possible to show that you cannot extend this function anymore to cause the population to move away from this point if you throw a new mutant in at small frequency, then we would call that a final stop. And the question is, what are properties of such a final stop? Can we characterize them somehow? And now, in order to go about this, one has to first, just a few technical remarks. One clearly has to say, what does it mean? But I said this essentially already. What does it mean to introduce a new allele? So we have the original genetic state, which is the frequency histogram of all the chromosomes, or the genotypes that you can think of. And as soon as you introduce this new allele, you get new genotypes, all the genotypes that contain the new allele. And the phenotype specification function, this function U in the picture, is not defined for that. So you have to extend that function. You have to say, how is that defined? And in the simple form of this theory, we do not impose any restrictions on that. We just allow any extension to take place. And so that is what it means to create a new allele mathematically. And then we have to ask, I mean, how can we capture the spirit of these final stops? So what do we want to have there? What we want to have is, we want to say, if we throw our allele AN plus 1 into the population, and if it's only an epsilon fraction, or a very small fraction of the population that contains this new allele, will the population return to its original state or not? The simple stability question, asymptotic stability question. But there's one problem here, namely that we have these two layers. We have the genetic level and the phenotypic level. And since this is about phenotypic theory, what we are really concerned about is whether the phenotypic feature is constant. And we do not worry, we are not interested to show that you always get back to the same genetic state. As long as the phenotypic feature remains constant, it's fine with us. Yes? Let's perhaps talk about the, because this is a... Sure, but let's perhaps postpone this question until we see the whole theory, because I first want to complete the picture, and then we can discuss that. So it is a bit complicated what one wants to require here, because it's essentially what I'm after here is necessary conditions for such a final stop. What we have to require is essentially is that if you have a genetic state with a corresponding phenotypic state of your population, and you throw in such a new allele AN plus 1, what you want to happen is that, first of all, that at the phenotypic level, you in the limit go back to the original state without making much of a detour, I mean the usual stability idea, stability and asymptotic convergence. And so that is, it's not the stability of the genetic state, which is, and the reason is that especially with frequency dependent selection, you have so many equivalent genetic states that give you rise to the same thing at the, and then one can actually show the following theme. So this is what I just emphasized. The population mean strategy returns, but the genetic state may or may not return if the state has the stability property. And the interesting theorem one can show is the following. If a population state is, if a genetic population state is phenotypically stable against this perturbation, then the mean population strategy P must be a best response to P in the phenotypic game. It must satisfy the first ESS condition of John Maynard Smith. Here we talk about a symmetric game being played at the surface. And what this means is that the Nash equilibrium shows up in this theory as a necessary condition for such a final stop.
You discuss this in terms of animal behavior. Do you think it applies to protein folding? amino acid substitutions give rise to the same tree destruction?
Well, yeah, perhaps I'm a bit. Let's perhaps first discuss it a bit more in the context for which it was designed, and then there's another interesting aspect, namely that if we look at a special state where, although there may be variation at the genetic level, phenotypically they all play the same strategy. A monomorphic case, so to speak, at least a phenotypically monomorphic case, then one has an even stronger theorem, namely that if a monomorphism is phenotypically stable against genetic perturbation, then P is an ESS Sensu-Menard-Smith. So the second ESS condition that I talked about on Monday is also satisfied that. Unfortunately, we originally thought that it would even go the other way, that we could have a sufficient condition, but that turned out to be false. That was a mistake in our proof, unfortunately. And so I don't want to go too much into this second statement here, because it doesn't help, really. I mean, we have to face the fact that all this is necessary conditions and no more. And the reason why I'm not so worried about it all is that since we mainly talk about this invasion problem and not about stability in general, we know anyway that we do not deal with all aspects of stability in this theory. So, to summarize this, there are two theorems. One deals with general final stops that can be phenotypically polymorphic or not, in which case we get at least the Nash equilibrium as a necessary condition. If we assume that it is a phenotypically monomorphic case, we get even the second Maynard-Smith. We get the two Maynard-Smith conditions for an ESS, which shows that this idea even survives in the world of fairly complicated models of genetics, if only one has the right look at these models, if one asks the right questions about them. Now, one can ask now, and here I come to what price has to be paid for all this. What is it that, if the population comes to a halt at a stop that does not correspond to an ESS or a Nash equilibrium, what kind of mutant would it be in practice that destabilizes such a thing? And there is two things one can say. I mean, for example, it could be that you get some mutation that has the same effect that the double heterozygote has as a homozygote or so, or say a dominant allele that would have a similar effect to the double heterozygote, that would kill the problem. But you may say, well, but how the hell should this come about? It is interesting to see that in the simple case of sickle cell anemia, which can also be looked up on through the eyes of this theory, sickle cell anemia is different in the sense that it's not, at least a simple picture of it would not be frequency dependent, and so it's the simplest model of it would be a frequency independent selection model with just one gene, where the heterozygote has the highest fitness. And that would be exactly a prime example of what we would call a temporary stop in our picture. And we think that it is not by accident that the prime example that we find in textbooks is one to do with host-parasite interactions. Because, I mean, these things tend to be notoriously instable and unstable. And but it is also interesting, if one really looks at the facts about sickle cell anemia, it is not true that it is a one-locus model that explains the facts there, because people have already found another gene which has a very strong effect in relation to malaria resistance, and where if you had not this gene, you would have much more of the sickle cell allele. So the reason why we see very little of the sickle cell allele is because there has already been an AN plus one type of mutation that actually does a lot of what the heterozygote normally stands for. So the modern picture of sickle cell anemia is one where things at least have halfway gone towards the final stop. And then the other thing is that there is, although that is not exactly depicted in our mathematical picture here, there is an easy way how, well, not an easy, but there is one way how very elementary molecular mechanisms would be able to destroy a temporary stop. And that would go as follows. Suppose, and let's stick to the sickle cell anemia case because that's the simplest of all examples one can think of. So suppose you have this heterozygote advantage and you need allele A and allele B to be expressed in order to get the resistance against malaria. And now why is there a problem? The problem is that you don't have these things on the same chromosome. That's the main trouble. Now what would be the molecular processes that would get these things onto the same chromosome? You would think, okay, we know that gene duplication is something that happens quite a lot. So suppose that allele B gets duplicated. What do we get then? We have a chromosome with B and B. And all you need then in addition to this is an unequal crossing over so that that you get A and B on the same chromosome. So in two steps at least, processes at the molecular level that are known to exist would transform the genetic system into something where the whole problem vanishes anyway. And I know that Ben Seung Lee, for example, in Chicago, he's supposed to send me his material, has lots of facts that have at least the flavor that looks like such a process has taken place in the past. And I think it's an interesting research theme to ask the question, I mean, how often did that really happen? I mean, because if it can happen in principle, it doesn't mean that it will happen in practice, as we know. There may, for example, be, once you have the duplication, there may be dosage problems. But as far as I understand, things are not that. I mean, there is some robustness with regard to dosage, at least. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, the closest thing reminds me of is Barbara McClintock, you know, the great geneticist. That's one of the great problems in biology from her point of view is polyploidy and why it is that, say, plants are so amazingly tolerant. They're doubling their number of chromosomes. And animals can't deploy without too much problem.
So if there's not too much of a problem with dosage, then I think it would. On the other hand, we know that dosage compensation, I mean, in these cases, where
some genomes and some things can handle it very well. Plants as a whole are just amazing at it. And animals as a whole, not so good. But there are, of course, kinds of deer or something that have twice the number of chromosomes, much less, just a little more.
But now, to return to your question, if we invoke the process that I just invoked, namely gene duplication and unequal crossing over, then at least we get longer chromosomes and we surely increase the number of genes. And in this sense, there's a price that's to be paid for it. If it goes the other way, that a mutation takes place where, say, a dominant allele achieves the same thing that normally the double heterozygote or the single heterozygote would achieve, that would not increase complexity, I think. That would be a way to, although one would have to worry about what did this other gene stand for to begin with, maybe that another function is then disturbed. But if that is a function of lower fitness, if that has a lower fitness effect, then that would be the cost to be paid for it, that you do better with regard to malaria, but you lose somewhere else a little bit. So I agree, it is probably not cost-free. And this is also why I think what one should expect is that this mechanism of evolution works whenever we deal with strong fitness effects. Whenever something is really in the way of Darwinian adaptation, then these costs can be paid because you gain a lot from it. However, if it's a tiny little bit of adaptation, a very small fitness effect, then I would not expect these things to. So I don't want to push the argument too far. It's.
I mean, one could iterate the scheme, say, your final stop, the final stop, because it has phenotype space, for instance. Like,
sure.
Like,
yeah.
Phenotype.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing is, I'm not the person who wants to say that evolution stands still. And I'm aware of the fact that this is a model here where we look at a fixed environment. So in reality, there are always. But then, like in physics, when you do adiabatic approximation, what you really assume here is that certain things are changing very slowly so that you don't worry about that change.
What I mean, if you wanted to make the model, but where you had a strategy n plus one, you would basically the same techniques would be applicable to then derive necessary conditions.
Yeah. You could say the chimpanzee who invents the machine gun also would be very successful, perhaps. So why not take that an plus one into consideration? I mean, the gene for manufacturing a machine gun or so. But obviously, we would not take that example serious. And the difference, I think, on the one hand, I think you are right. I mean, there is always scope for some innovation that is not taken into account of, and that may all of a sudden pop up. And maybe that the major steps in evolution always had to do with such things that are not very easily coming about. But here, the point I want to make is that we want, normally in these evolutionary games, we look at strategy spaces that are within, that are plausible biologically, that are not unrealistic, unlike the machine gun case. And we are dealing here with the problem if genetics is, although all these things are plausible in principle and can be even realized genetically in principle, if there are these genetic constraints that cause the evolutionary path of the population to deviate from what phenotypic evolution would predict, then how serious is that problem? I mean, to what extent should that really disturb our picture of evolution? And I think that these considerations show that whenever you deal with substantial selection pressures, it's not convincing that genetics will be in the way of adaptation. Although, and that is the cost argument, if it's a very subtle adaptation where you only gain an epsilon or so, then yes, sure, I would agree. I would not necessarily expect this kind of adaptation to take place then. But with epsilons, we have other problems too. I mean, we heard this talk of Professor Ota about near neutrality. And if populations are of a very finite size, then we know anyway that selection gets overwhelmed by the stochasticity.
Like to think of this kind of thing of this partial equilibrium in terms of time scale. So
yes.
You see, you have at least three different ones. The first one is the time you need to go to an intermediate.
Yes.
Stop.
Yeah.
And then maybe the frequency of these larger genomic rearrangements that you come from one intermediate stop to the next.
Yes. Yes.
Stop.
Yeah.
And then the one Walter just mentioned, the frequency with which the rules of the game must
yes.
change.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Change and yeah. Or because some major advantage of mutation,
yeah.
Say that one population. Okay. It seems you have a definite time ordering of
yes.
Time.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
First of all, you reach the frequency of the genomic replacement is rare enough that you reach the temporary stop before something happens. And secondly, the rules of the game are sufficiently
The
final stop is reached.
Yeah.
Is there a feeling what class of cases this is
Well, I mean, I did the most extensive game theoretic study I ever did was on spiders who live in the deserts of North America and Middle America, and there we knew that environment was pretty much the same for thousands of generations for these spiders, So that what we were studying was at least pretty close to what the evolutionary scenario was like. And so there we felt pretty safe in applying such models. Now, if you have, on the other hand, if you look at human evolution, where things change very quickly, especially because there's the dynamics of culture, where within one generation, people develop completely different ideas. When I was a student, many students in Germany thought that they should be communists because that would solve all problems of the world, despite the fact that real communism existed next door and did not look very promising. And then at that time, nobody was concerned about protecting the environment or so. And then all of a sudden, it all switched to became a movement about protection of the environment, and who knows what it will be next. And all this within two decades or so, and much less than one generation's lifetime. And now, clearly, you can then not separate these scales so easily. And this is, I think, why one has to be particularly cautious about human evolution. On the other hand, I mean, I should mention here that in Santa Barbara there exists a Center for Evolutionary Psychology, which was founded by Lida Kosmides and John Tooby, who have actually initiated a movement in psychology to seriously consider the application of evolutionary biology to human behavior, the picture they have is, I mean, they are very well aware of the fact that things are changing very fast and that we may not be adapted to the current environment. But that our mind was shaped, I mean, the way how we make decisions and how our basic actions are controlled, that was shaped during a long period where humans lived in tribal communities, where things not necessarily were so different, I mean, over many generations. So that if we want to understand how we behave in modern society, we have to imagine what would it be like in a tribal community. And we had a discussion before this talk started about, for example, what it means to gain status. So for example, in a tribal community, it could very well be that to gain status means access to resources and to mating partners. Whereas in modern society, for example, in Germany, if you are a professor, you still have a high status, but it doesn't necessarily mean access to resources. We are not that well paid, nor does it mean that mating partners are lining up as they would do for politicians, for example. I mean, it's so in a sense, so in a sense, there is what you get is then an uncoupling of things that. That certain forms of status may still be coupled with these, with resources and access to mating partner also, but other forms of status may no longer be like this, but our behavior would still be governed to gain status. And maybe this is why I'm sitting here in this room.
There is another, in terms of whether animals are doing,
yeah.
Not
yes.
Sort of yep. Paradox of A, B being much more fit than A, A and B, B.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there are cases in which the fitness, the commutation makes the fitness of AA and BB so bad that in fact they are not born, they are so unfit that they are not fit to actually even
well in sickle cell
at the molecular level to get born. Are such cases found? Because it seems a good adaptation. See what I mean?
Yes. Well, in sickle cell anemia, there is this case where you would hardly produce any offspring, but you are still born. So there it is not done that way. But I don't know of it. I mean, one thing is clear. I mean, there is a lot of abortions probably take place because something is wrong with a developing embryo or so.
This is why this is still costly for the mother to have the AA there, risk her life, and then nothing good comes out of it.
Mm-hmm.
A good adaptation would be that once there is a child with AA, it's aborted before even...
And then mate again and try to produce an AB or so. But I don't know of an example of that. I don't know. Because, I mean, it would require knowledge of all these. I mean, it's not so easy.
I must have missed something very basic.
When you
introduce a neuon now, actually introduce the fitness function changes, right? This W, then there are more entries, right? W
is I, J, K.
Assume something about the W.
In this framework, there's a game theoretic model that describes phenotypic interaction and the fitness effects of what happens if you play this strategy against another strategy and so forth. And the new L here does not invent any new strategy, and therefore
the fitness only depends on strategy.
And since that is defined in the game, we don't have to. Otherwise, you are right. Otherwise, we would have to extend the fitness function as well. But this dispute, the one I'm addressing here, is one where it is not about it's not so much about novelty in terms of phenotypic novelty. It's about genotypic constraints that don't make it possible to achieve something in evolution, which in principle would be there in terms of.
So you're talking about the infinitesimal stability, right?
Infinitesimal
and how stable it is.
Sure.
There must be cases in which, perhaps there are cases in which it may be infinitesimally stable, but of course, if you suddenly by a fluctuation makes a big jump, it would become unstable. Switch it off?
Oh no. Maybe
the recording.
Maybe before I start.
The coffee and everything.
Yeah. Before I start to make nasty comments about Michael also. So everything I say now will be held against me. So let me quickly repeat what the first part of this little theater play was. The discussion was about how to capture the idea of adaptation, of Darwinian adaptation. And there was the first population geneticist who invoked the sickle cell anemia example, one gene, frequency independent selection, heterozygote advantage, to show that if you try to look at adaptation at the phenotypic level, you get it wrong. But if you instead use at the fitness landscape, the way Sewell Wright used it, where it is a landscape over a genetic space of the population rather than phenotypes, that you then can find a maximization principle, that you get an equilibrium underneath the peak of this hill, fitness hill. Then the next step was to let this Australian mathematician Moran come into play, who showed that this idea is fallacious, because if you, as soon as you invoke more than one gene with recombination, it is no longer true that you walk uphill, and it's also no longer true that the equilibrium must be underneath the fitness peak. And what I forgot to say was that in some sense, this is the death of the whole idea of the fitness landscape as a function of genetic space, because you cannot really trust that mapping.
How is the Moran's example different from the sickle cell example?
The difference is that it's two genes that recombine, but it's in some sense it is very similar in spirit. Yes. Yeah. And then the next step was that what I called the new wave adaptationist, who wanted to show that after all adaptation takes place at the phenotypic level, where at the scenario where selection operates in the first place. Now, the argument he uses is that if, because of these genetic constraints, the population gets stuck somewhere where you do not have phenotypic principles working, then you could always imagine a new allele that comes into play, for example, that would actually drive the population away from the point, from that point, or you could imagine a process such as gene duplication and unequal crossing over to solve that problem as well. And the only points which are then fairly stable against all these kinds of perturbations are the ones that correspond to the logic of phenotypic modeling. And because in the case of frequency independent selection, a fitness maximum, and in the case of frequency dependent selection, a Nash equilibrium, and as a necessary condition. And what that shows is, interestingly, that there is a striking similarity between what an economist would do. If an economist sees a game and computes a solution, then they are always looking for Nash equilibria. If an evolutionary biologist looks at even these complicated models with genetics and several loci in them, then there are certain, if one adopts the logic of the Stritka approach, then one would also think that the Nash equilibria play a particular important role in this analysis. And this is perhaps why one can use these paradigms where one does as if animals were decision, these as if ideas, where you treat the animal as if it was a rational decision maker trying to maximize fitness or so. That is, I think, the deeper justification for it. But you had a question?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. The main philosophical
yes. Yes.
The population geneticists do not distinguish between genotype and phenotype. They just think of genotype or just think of phenotype. Then, what the advantage of thinking in terms of genotype and phenotype, as you do, is that you can make a distinction between when you're stuck because of phenotypic reasons or when you're stuck
yes.
because of
sure.
genotype.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can ask the question, if I'm stuck for genotypic reasons, will that really be the end of the story? Yeah.
Yeah. Good question about this, Moran.
Yes, yes.
Does it apply in the cases where the two genes are so-called epistatic in the way that population biologists use this? Or does it apply, or and?
Yeah.
Does it apply to the case when the two genes are acting quite independently, yeah, but have the so the total effect if, would be kicking you when you're down.
You do not run into these problems if you assume that each gene has a fitness effect that is completely independent of the rest, if it's additive or so. But already, if you assume multiplicative relationships, then you run into the problem. So what some people call multiplicative non-epistasis, even then you have the problem. Whether one would want to call that non-epistasis or not is another question, but it's... So the only way to be safe would be to live in this very simple-minded world where all the fitness effects are additive. And that's actually the world that is underlying the book of Richard Dawkins called The Selfish Gene, because that's when his art reasoning works.
And it can be haploid. So you can be haploid with epistasis and you can still have problems. Because your example's a little different.
That's true. I mean, here we talk about diploid organisms and all the trouble we are dealing with. The trouble we are dealing with here is related to diploid. Wait a second. No. I think you have this with haploid. Well, I mean, if you let me say it this way, if you have haploid and recombination, then you have the problem, don't you? Although you cannot, you cannot have this double heterozygote then.
Well, you still have the same relation together.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. Okay. In this sense, yes. Okay, yeah. I think you are right. That's. Let me now invoke another, just one remark which always makes me smile a little bit. I mean, humans always claim the rationality, monopoly on rationality for themselves. But what this theory, and we know from experiments in psychology that doesn't seem to be the case. I mean, humans make so many big mistakes in decision making. Whenever people try to check the theory of rational decision making empirically, that it doesn't look very much like we are good rational decision makers. But the process of evolution, if it makes a decision for the animal, in the sense that it programs it for a specific situation, is much better in getting things right. So this is a sort of a crazy rationality of the evolutionary decision making. It doesn't mean that the animal is good at analyzing problems, and we are perhaps much better than all animals in terms of analyzing new situations and our cognitive skills and all that. But when it comes to, but what we then come up with is often not what a mathematician would call a good rational solution, and or what an economist would call a rational decision. Whereas if you let animals act as robots that are programmed by a computer program that evolution has designed for these situations, then they are much better off. That's an interesting comment. Yes?
Can one speculate that being irrational from time to time is a rational strategy? I mean, like a poker player, you can guess your make your opponent guessing.
I have done that myself in games where people didn't know me, trying to give the impression that I'm even more stupid than I am. And that had a good then they didn't pay so much, then they didn't fear me so much.
Right.
And now that is clear in a world where people are in different states. So for example, some have more trained their skills to do certain things, and where there may also be genetic differences underlying it, then clearly it can be a good idea to give the impression that you are not rational in such a situation. Yes, I agree. But that is not the reason why we are normally not fully rational. We just cannot be. We are not, for example, we are not able to handle probabilities in our routine decision making. And that is true for mathematicians, it is true for statisticians, it's true for physicists, and no matter how close they are to the Nobel Award, what comes out in these experiments is that everybody makes very elementary mistakes to do with conditional expectation. I mean, we are very bad at computing things such as conditional expectations and so forth. And when you go to a doctor and you are worried about the disease, and you should also be worried about the doctor's interpretation of tests, because that can be...
Documented by the Hahnemann and...
Yes, exactly. But
I think that Tony was the question is more in the direction of situations like getting curious or having vendetta kind of behavior.
Yes,
which
I agree. I mean, this is a very interesting point, because in a sense, vendetta often would not be the... Or let me give another example. If you are in your house and a thief is coming, then maybe you have a sign outside, "I will defend my property," or so, and "beware of myself," or something like this. And now at the moment where the thief really comes, the best thing clearly is to run away. Then you lose your TV set, and otherwise you lose your life, perhaps. And I mean, what a comparison. So I always tell my students, if you're in this situation, take off as quick as you can and don't forget about vendetta and these things. But it's but then in reality, I know that our emotions are not.
If you are in a little village in the Middle East, then you better defend, because otherwise they will come the next day. Okay?
That is an interesting point. Yeah.
No, but I know a very famous German theoretical physicist in Heidelberg, which is a fairly peaceful town. And exactly this example, there was an intruder with an axe, and he actually decided to fight the axe. Fight the intruder. It was totally irrational. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's probably, and it's and I can tell you, I mean, there was a time when the Cold War was still very strong between East and West, where the American government had decided to spend a lot of money on research on arms control, and as usual, the administration doesn't know how to spend the money. They want to spend it all in one big chunk, because that's the easiest way to do it. And some game theorists said, "Well, let's organize a series of game theory conferences about arms control." And in those days, they tried to work out the logic of deterrence. And the first thing they realized was that deterrence does not really work if you're in a model, because I mean, to give you one example, if you have two countries, one that has big missiles and tanks, and the other one that only has the big missiles, and suppose that the president of the country that also has tanks sends the tanks across the border and gives the president a phone call saying, "Look, we only want this little province of yours that's rich of oil, and you can keep the rest. Don't be foolish. Don't push the button to send your missile, because then I have to push mine and we will all be dead." Now, clearly, a rational president would have to say, "Well, that's too bad for me. I better let them get the oil instead of all of us being killed." And he cannot push the button if he's rational. And the other one, knowing this, would send his tanks. And this is, in a sense, the logic of flexible response that was discussed a lot in those days. But in reality, what they came up with is that the reason why international deterrence works is because people actually do believe that the president can be stupid enough to push the button. and that applies to all presidents, no matter which country. So that is what makes it dangerous. That's why the deterrence works, because there is this component in our behavior that by getting angry or so, something is done, which one would not do if one thought carefully. And that is a very interesting aspect, which I think in the current model world is not really captured. I have an idea about that. Namely, that it only works probably if you include elements of the underlying mechanistic machinery that controls behavior. Because if you then, by describing that machinery, if you can say, "Now I set my machinery in a mode that all I can, that for the next 5 minutes, the least thing will cause me to stab you, and there's nothing I can do about it because it's designed that way," also, then it becomes a credible threat. But one would then have to think about why this machinery cannot evolve away from the state to become more flexible. So I think without the addition of some picture of the machinery that actually produces behavior, it would be very difficult to get it. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. give the standard Ebbsleit conjecture about both types of irrationality, both yeah. the sort of irrationality when it comes to computing intelligibility, and also the irrationality with that. And in both cases, the conjecture, anyway, is that human psychology evolved a very different social environment than what it is. And adaptation, including psychological adaptation, is only evolving in response to long-term selection pressures. Consequently, our brains and the architecture of our brains are presumed to have evolved to solve problems in testable environments, and they may not solve problems in our environments. So in the case with probability, you say, 49%, it's an evolutionarily novel piece of information. We haven't evolved to really understand how to compute that. Whereas if you say 3 out of 5, that's probably something people were dealing with all the time. And in fact, psychological experiments show that if you couch probability problems in frequencies, people are much better at solving them than if you couch them in terms of probabilities. And then the same might hold for some of these other problems, that the way that you compute or respond to them would have been rational in an accessible environment. And then the same might hold for the other type of irrationality too. That some of the things like fighting the intruder might seem very irrational today, but in a small community, there isn't any place for one else. You might be raided, and your village might be surrounded by raiders. You really have no choice but to fight. I'm just feeling that out of
order. Walter, you want to challenge him on this?
No, just before this goes too far, I would say, why play off always rationality and irrationality rather than using a different perspective as Stephen Tolman proposed, you don't only have rationality, you also have reasonable rationality, which is different from rationality, and different from irrationality.
What's the definition?
Well, the definition is that how the president of the country responds, will depend highly on the particular circumstances. And you have to take context into account. You can't just say there's just one possible response, one thing, which is button and go. It just depends on a lot of other factors involved. And so you might come to a decision that in one particular context is reasonable in another particular category. In one particular context would be rational, in another context would be irrational. In this context you kind of be absorbed by saying
In any case, the kind of even irrationality of the type of the first type, as you define this, we did insert in the irrationality of investor participant anomalies. We didn't insert in models of stock markets, and there is a book, it cost 69.99 in Academic Press. Which completely makes this implementation of non-rational existence behavior in the economic theory.
I want to insert the idea I learned from Gumbridge Stent at UC Berkeley, and his particular hit was that human brains evolved under two interesting kinds of pressure: one to be rational in terms of understanding the world, which is, after all, gives rise to the sciences. And the other is the human social interaction, which is in particular dependent on the assumption that the other beings have free will. And it's certainly the basis of all social interaction, which means that it's not deterministic, it's not rational in that sense. It's expected that the other members of your tribe, family, community, state, and so on have responsibility for their actions, which they wouldn't if it were simply, moving without free will.
But free will is a very difficult
thing. Humans have to evolve, and the human society, human brain, has to evolve with that assumption. In other people, and capable of putting that assumption onto other things, as surely as we have to evolve with the idea that the aspects of the world have rational behavior.
I think that irrationality as a phrase is advantageous for humans because because their decision-making is very complex, and it's not enough of a lifetime to make a correct decision. The decision should be made right away. Therefore, introducing the rational spectrum of decisions, you simultaneously introduce a proportion of non-trivial decisions. This way, discoveries are made.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a sense, the way Reinhard Selten, who thought a lot about in economics about this problem of rational decision making, what he would say similar things. I mean, that if you really want to be rational, it is so complicated that the smallest problem you face, it would take more than your lifetime to figure out what the actually the rational way would be to deal with it. And it's not astonishing that, I mean, we have generations of theoreticians working out the what rational decision means in certain games and so forth. And so in practice that cannot be done. And so what you need instead is rules of thumb or whatever it is called that allow you to decide quickly and to come up with reasonable results on average. And although in certain situations you would do something very foolish. And I mean, he also made the important comment that we shouldn't forget that we, after all, evolved in tribal communities, and if then there were no TV sets, I mean, this luxury stuff that we have nowadays, where you say if you have it or not doesn't make much of a difference, that was not the case there. If somebody stole your stored food, maybe you would not have survived the winter, and therefore it was very important to defend what you had in your storage. And you can tell, I mean, when I was traveling last year in the US, we were in a canyon where the Anasazi Indians had storage on a wall where they had to climb the rocks to reach that storage, and it was all to do with having a safe place to store their nutrients. And you know, in such a world, it may be extremely important to defend what you have, because otherwise you won't survive. But now we behave, if it's only for the TV set, we do as if it was for our life.
Many years ago, I was on the story on two rats, one of them was his high IQ and another just came stupid. And how they lived in New York. It appears that each day they found in the same corner of the switch a lump of cheese. Mm-hmm. At first they approached this cheese with extreme caution. They checked it out, they ate them. And next day it was the same. And after a while, the intellectual rat realize that it is a free cheese. And stupid continued to exercise caution. And on a certain day, it was a street meal. So it shows that if you are in the vicinity of a very complicated situation, which is unfriendly. So sometimes it's better to play stupid, not make a real probabilistic decision.
Yeah, can I would like to continue a little bit further because there is in my little theater play Richard Dawkins come. Actually, I give a talk in Oxford about the streetcar stuff, and he was very nervous. He wasn't there at the moment when I gave that talk, but then the next day he came and was very nervous. And if you ask, I mean, does he have a reason to be nervous about the streetcar theory? My answer would be yes and no. And let me tell you about the yes and the no. On the one hand, I mean, if you take him literally, what he said in, I think this was in the extended phenotype, it is my belief that if adaptations are to be treated as for the good of something, that something is the gene, well, one can have doubts about that. Because in the model world I showed you here, the genetics is extremely messy. And you cannot characterize equilibria in any general sense, and you don't get anywhere if you try to solve that at the genetic level, but you see very clearly at the phenotypic level where the process would come to a halt. In this sense, I disagree with him, but I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I was assuming that these genes are well behaved in the sense that Mendelian genetics works properly and so forth. So I was, in some sense, I did exclude the kind of genes that would be truly selfish in the sense of the selfish gene. And let me give you just a very short example of what happens if one really takes genetics into account. And I'm because of the fact that Cosmides and Tubi are here in the psychology in the is it the psychology? It's not the psychology department, is it? It's the anthropology department. It's also interesting that that two psychologists have found the came up with a story that I would like to give you very briefly, only touch very briefly. You probably all have heard, or many of you have heard of sex ratio theory, that Charles Darwin was rather worried about. Why is it the case that in so many species there are girls and boys are produced in roughly equal, sons and daughters are produced in roughly equal numbers? And he could not find the selective forces responsible for that. It took 50 years until Ronald Fisher came up with a picture. I don't want to go into that. And if one then asks, I mean, how does that relate to genetics? Then if it's, then the way to find a legitimation for his theory is to say that it is somehow under autosomal control, that the autosomes decide about the mechanism that is allowed to decide about the sex offspring. And and then 50 years later, 50 years after Fisher had come up with this theory, these two psychologists said, well, but you have overlooked one thing, namely that if you look at different parts in the genome, they are under very different selection pressure when it comes to the question of whether the offspring should be a boy or a daughter. And so Cosmides and Tubi in 1981 suggested that, if nuclear DNA has the last word to say about the mechanism that decides about boys and daughters, then it should be roughly 1-to-1. If it is cytoplasmic DNA, for example, in the mitochondria or so, then it should be 100% daughters, ideally. If these genes had to say what mechanism controls the sex of the offspring, for a very simple reason, I mean, they didn't have to do any mathematics to see that, because of cytoplasmic inheritance of these objects. If you are not transported via sperm into an offspring, then to be in a son means to be dead. It's a dead end. So since mitochondria are not transmitted like this, and sorry, I must.
But what is mitochondria to do with reproduction? I thought it just generates energy.
Yeah, but mitochondria have a genome. Uh-huh. Admittedly, not many genes are there. For example, a typical. I think then, if you ask, I mean, how many proteins are coded for by genes on the mitochondria, then it depends on which you look at, which organism. It can be as little as about 10, and it can be at most something like of the order of 60 or 70.
Does it participate in the reproductive process at all?
Well, that was an. What they said was only that if mitochondrial genes had any influence on that question. If it has any influence, then it would then these genes would be under selection to code for daughter production.
So that's a very big if.
And it's a very big if, and obviously the next thing I wanted to say is, are we pushing the theory too far by making such, that was clearly something, but I mean, first of all, there was something that actually supports the idea is that in plants, it was known that there is a phenomenon called male sterility, where male function is suppressed, and it is suppressed by the effect of mitochondrial genes, interestingly. And so that was something they had in mind, that where they thought that supports the argument. Now, in animals, I do not know of any example, but in animals, there's two differences between plants and animals here. One is that animals have even fewer genes on the mitochondria. So the mitochondrial genomes are smaller in animals. And that would also mean less of an opportunity to interfere. And the other thing is that in plants, very often you have organisms that produce that have both sexual functions in the same organism. And then it is probably easier, hermaphrodites, then it is easier to interfere, because then you only have to somehow mess up the switch, whereas otherwise it might be more complicated. So that could be one reason. And I think they thought along these lines. And but this is, you could say, when they did this, they knew about these facts. So this is not a prediction in any sense. But the interesting thing is that then, I mean, people got aware of the existence of a bacterium called Wolbachia, which lives in the cytoplasm and is transmitted like a very much like a mitochondrion. The only difference is that Wolbachia still has its, well, probably the full genome. But it's also cytoplasmically inherited via eggs to the offspring. And well, you would say if this thing is in possession of its full genome, it should have more of a chance to interfere than mitochondrial genes. And what this Wolbachia does is absolutely amazing. I mean, it, for example, in actually it is found in arthropods and in nematodes, and I'm here only talking about the arthropod examples. In a woodlouse, Armadillidium vulgare, they have a sex determination system like in birds originally, where the heterogametic sex is female.
Is determining the sex of the host or itself?
We are talking about the host here.
The host.
And the host, without the influence of the bacterium, the host has the following system, like very much like in birds. It has two sex chromosomes, W and Z, and if it's WZ, the heterozygote, then this becomes a female. If it's WZ, if it's homozygous for Z, then it develops into a male. But now comes the thing. If it is WZ, which would be normally a male, but infected with that bacterium, then it develops into a female. It transforms a genetic male into a female. And now how does it do that? It's done by inhibiting the differentiation of the androgenic gland, and it does more things. I mean, it, for example, it also blocks androgen receptors and so forth. And what happens in a model, people have done simple models of this, where they, for example, assumed 90% transmission of Wolbachia into via eggs, that not all eggs contain the Wolbachia. What you get if you start with a population where you have regular males and females, and now you throw in a small proportion of these infected males that are then functionally females, then you get a very steep increase of these false females, and the true females die out. And if you ask what is here at the end, what is the proportion of males, why are there any males left in the end? Why doesn't the whole population die out because of lack of males? It's because the assumption of 90% transmission of Wolbachia, this means that de novo males are always generated due to the lack of complete transmission of the bacterium. But in this model, at least, the equilibrium frequency of males is exactly the remaining 10% of eggs that have not received the bacterium. And one could say, well, is this perhaps just the evolution of a new sex-determining mechanism that is in the interest of the organism that has the bacterium? And well, now it's just done another way. Who cares? I mean,
yeah. What is the fitness advantage to the bacterium?
The fitness advantage to the bacterium is that it will not be, if it sits in a male, it will not be transmitted to the next host generation.
Oh, I see.
Yeah?
I see.
So it's not transmitted via sperm, only via eggs.
Because it's tied to the mitochondria somehow.
Yeah, it sits in the same boat with the mitochondria, if you like, in the cytoplasm, and cytoplasmic DNA is not allowed to enter the zygote. And clearly one could say here, well, maybe it's not so bad for the host because it's just another mechanism of sex determination. Who cares? These things change over time. But if the transmission rate of Wolbachia determines the sex ratio, then this is not likely to be the sex ratio that is in the interest of the host. Because, I mean, Wolbachia has an interest to have a high transmission rate, so it will be under evolution to have a high transmission. And the host may want to have an equal 50-50 sex ratio, and there's no theoretical reason why these things should correspond. I mean, so it is a conflict between host and the bacterium here, an interesting conflict. And let me also tell you that Wolbachia is much more innovative than this. I mean, this bacterium has found several other ways of reaching the same goal, of circumventing the problem of
the symbiosis between mitochondria and Wolbachia.
But you see, the tricks here. Well, it actually it is. You are right. I mean, it is good for the mitochondria too. That's true. Yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, they are all dependent on the mitochondria. Without ATP in the cell, the Wolbachia also would be dead. Then another trick that Wolbachia comes up with is it induces parthenogenesis. And let me only explain to you how it does that very quickly. Maybe I should use this slide here. There is in social insects, they have a special, in hymenopterans, I mean bees, wasps, and ants, they have a special genetic system called haplodiploidy, where females are diploid and males are haploid. And the female is able to trigger an unfertilized haploid egg mechanically, and then it develops into a male. So haploid, in the species I'm talking about, haploid individuals develop into males, and diploid that result from fertilization develop into females. And the normal way how the female can control the sex ratio is by, she has a storage for sperm called the spermatheca, and a tap and a muscle that she can contract or not. And if the egg comes by, if you like, then she can either open the tap and then sperm drops on the egg and it will be fertilized, or she can contract the muscle, in which case no fertilization takes place. And in this sense, she has full control over the sex of the offspring. That's the regular system. Now, suppose you are a Wolbachia, how would you fool this system? How can you induce parthenogenesis? Parthenogenesis here is meant that what that means is that the female produces daughter without the help of any male. Problem is, she is already able to produce sons with the help of any male, and sons don't have fathers in the system normally. I mean, this is the starting point. And what you, if you were a Wolbachia and you could think about how to solve your problem, one way of, actually I give my students, I often give them these problems, say, if you were a Wolbachia, how would you do it? And then they sometimes come up with the right idea, is what one would say is, well, maybe Wolbachia should exploit the fact that the female is able to get this undeveloped egg to develop, but then it should somehow make sure that this becomes diploid instead of haploid. But how do you get that to become diploid if no fertilization takes place? There is a moment. If you look at the first mitotic division, so here you have the haploid egg, mother triggers it mechanically, and development starts. And then you get, during the first mitotic division, it begins with a duplication of the chromosomes, and then they should be pulled apart to form the core, so to speak, of the next daughter cells. And this is exactly where Wolbachia interferes. It makes sure that after the duplication of these chromosomes, the first mitotic division is aborted. And that has the effect then that the haploid egg is transformed into something diploid, and that develops into a female. And so it is interesting to see that the way it works, how such parasites, genetic parasites, act is not by inventing a very elaborate system themselves, but by disturbing the process in a clever way, so that by this disturbance So all they have to make sure is that this pulling apart of the chromosome doesn't function properly. And there they have the diploid organism. Because with the tap, okay, that would be another possibility, sure, yeah. To somehow do something about the muscle that it is always relaxed. Yeah, sure. But this is, as to my knowledge, something... To my knowledge, it's something that Wolbachia has not invented. I don't know a case where that's been reported. What is interesting, though, is that these tricks of interfering with mitosis, there are other selfish elements that are not even organisms. For example, B chromosomes, small fragments of chromosomes that do very similar tricks. So that seems to be fairly easy, I mean, to disrupt mitotic divisions in such a way. That seems to be an easy thing to achieve.
Are all wild populations?
No, the fact is that in insects, for example, about 20% of the insect populations are infected with Wolbachia. So it's widespread. But I don't want to claim that in all cases it is such a parasitic relationship, because the cases that are best known are the parasitic cases, where it's fairly clear cut that Wolbachia does something that's not in the interest of the host. But whether that is true for all these 20%, I mean, I'm not so sure about that. Yeah.
If there is a parasitic coexistence, then it could really increase the rate of humans. And this host probably has some evolutionary reason why it not increase this rate.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So probably it doesn't get too much advantage, because these extra humans, they are just evolution.
No, the thing is, the females will not die out. I mean, it's part of the, it's a very interesting story. I mean, the basic sex ratio theory is, what is so funny is that there is one sex, namely the males, that usually do not contribute anything substantial to the reproductive business. It's almost all done by the females. Because they don't invest into eggs, and in most cases also they don't invest into parental care and all these things, and so all they give is sperm, and then one male is perfectly capable of fertilizing the eggs of, in many species that is true, that one male is able to fertilize the eggs of many females just within a few hours or so, and therefore if all animal breeders dream of having a biased sex ratio. If you are a cattle breeder, you hate the idea that your cattle produces daughters and sons in equal proportions. You want to have a genotype that produces, say, 9 females and 1 son. That would be the most, from the point of view of the population, that would be the most efficient. And for this same reason, it is not the case that these females that are, if you get a female by a sex ratio here, that these females die out or anything like this.
So in this one,
what is an extra number? I mean, it's these are parasitic wasps, I must say. They are not social here, and they lay their eggs. They parasitize some larvae or so, and lay their eggs, and the female goes up and happily flies away and produces eggs. And no matter what the sex ratio is, they do that. And if there is competition, then there would be competition with the males as well, and they would equally suffer. I mean, it's
of
the species. Yes, that's true. Yeah, it is true. It's actually helping. In this sense, it has a positive effect. It does exactly what the what the animal breeder would like to achieve. Yes, sure. Yeah. Yes, you are right.
So, I mean, there is sort of
sure. If there's anything true about our ideas of why sex is maintained, then in the long run that should be a disaster. Sure, yes. But these animal breeders, they do not think in long. I mean, their thinking is not governed. They want short-term success.
Well, they're not
asking.
Yeah. I mean, they want females, but they're not asking for.
Yeah, yeah, sure, yeah. So that's
the miners are parasites themselves. They're not the food.
It puzzling how this bacteria would recognize the difference between first and second mitosis? I mean,
yes. Well, yeah. I mean, the molecular mechanism is unknown. Like in many other cases, it is clearly very a thrilling problem to figure out how it is really done. But it's simply the facts are not known.
First case where you have a way to kind of sex ratio in the presence of the site, is it known how this evolved? I mean, the genes that give Wolbachia this capacity must have somehow been important to the host.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I mean, we have there was a big major conference on Wolbachia last year, and they said that by the end of the year the genome would be sequenced, and it is true that this has been done, but it doesn't mean that it's available to us. So I haven't seen the data yet. It's a whole, I mean, it's not just one group, but there's a good. It's a God, what's the name? During the break, I'll come to mind.
I just want to say, last week, before I came here, spending a few months in my lab with Jack Hammond from New Zealand, when he's shown, I have a paper on the manuscript, of a conjugation of bacteria inside mammalian cells.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, so these are male and female bacteria, and they're taking up these tissue cultures inside the gorilla cell, and definitely, you know, well done experiments on conjugate inside of these cells. So they may be conjugating, of course, inside our body as well, you know, inside a certainly protected environment from any antibiotics and so on. In the context of Wolbachia and so on, of course, the thing to consider is that there's DNA transfer. And then, of course, the bacteria in our cells may be conjugating with our nucleus, they may be conjugating with our mitochondria,
mm-hmm.
and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, that's
so right. Here, of course, because you have the case of the tumor viruses in plants and mm-hmm. all these parasitic wasps may be transferring DNA into the trees and you get things going on too. So there's a lot of room for that. In plants, yeah. It's a very interesting case, the TI plasma. It's beautiful plants. And
I have to make up my mind. I mean, I could tell you yet another trick of Wolbachia, or switch to another subject. Would you?
My main suggestion is that you can tell us the other trick.
Okay.
And then we have still the
yeah. Okay. Okay. And because I mean the reason. Let me try to get back to why do I mention this Wolbachia example? It's because I didn't want to give the impression that it doesn't pay to look at the genome and the potential for conflict, especially if one wants to understand facts. And in this sense, I agree with Richard Dawkins that it's very important to have an open eye for these things. And the other reason why I mentioned it is because sometimes people say that theoreticians in evolutionary biology never come up with any prediction that is. But this was a very clear-cut. I mean, this idea that cytoplasmic DNA should produce female by sex, which was a very clear prediction, and Wolbachia is a wonderful example showing that it leads to something. And now there is one thing one could say, perhaps parthenogenesis and this sex change is something one could at least come up. My students every now and then come up with these ideas when I ask them. But there's one thing nobody comes up with, and that is the most delicate thing Wolbachia does. And it's also going beyond sex ratio theory now. But it's another way of dealing with the problem of being stuck in the male. And the interesting thing is that the facts that are relevant were discovered long before these theoretical arguments were brought up. But then people, it would have disappeared in these big fat books, volumes about facts in biology. Things are complicated and nobody would ever have cared about it. And it's only because of the theory that we find that we see why it exists and why it is interesting. And it's actually, if you, in my country, in Germany, there's a distinction that the North is Protestant and the South is Catholic in terms of those who are Christians. And there were wars all the time and they tried to. So in 1957, a biologist called Lavin did an experiment where he actually crossed Protestant mosquitoes with Catholic mosquitoes. So he took mosquitoes from Hamburg in northern Germany and crossed them with Catholic mosquitoes in southern Germany. And he found an interesting unidirectional reproductive incompatibility that the Pope would have loved to see. Namely, if he took a Protestant female from the north and crossed her with a Catholic male, in other words, from the southern population. Then they happily produced offspring. So the Catholic males made it easily with the Protestant females. But if you try to cross a Protestant male with a Catholic female, nothing successful happened. But this is a bit idealized, but at least in most of the cases there was no offspring. And clearly, the interesting question is obviously they haven't heard about religion, and the Pope hasn't been able to teach the mosquitoes anything. So the question is, why does that take place? And Levin himself had the suspicion, the conjecture, that a cytoplasmic factor was involved. And much, much later, and this was, for example, due to the work of Jack Well and others, to actually identify this factor. It's a long story. I omit the steps because. What we now know is the following: that the Protestant population was infected with Wolbachia, and that what's underlying all this is the following: if the male has a Wolbachia and the female has a Wolbachia, they happily produce offspring that also carries the Wolbachia. If the male has no Wolbachia and the female has a Wolbachia, they happily produce offspring that carries the Wolbachia, because Wolbachia is cytoplasmically transmitted. But now comes the strange thing: if the male has a Wolbachia and the female has none, then fertilization doesn't work. At the moment where there's the first mitotic division, you get improper condensation. The condensation of chromosomes is disrupted, and you don't get normal development. Now that is quite amazing, because in this upper case here, it worked well. And also we know that Wolbachia is not transmitted via sperm. It doesn't really enter the egg. So how the hell can this work? And I mean, to give you a caricature of what's happening here, it is as follows: that what the only interpretation one can have here is that if one really looks at all the facts that are known, is that Wolbachia does some manipulation of the sperm, and it actually sits where sperm. I mean, you find the Wolbachia where the sperm is being produced. Spermatogenesis is taking place.
I thought the Wolbachia nucleus only in the
but I mean, there are cells that are responsible for the production of sperm. And there you find Wolbachia. It sits in the neighborhood of where sperm is being produced. So if it sends out chemicals, these chemicals will somehow hit the sperm being under production. And so the interpretation is that Wolbachia manipulates the sperm. If that sperm hits an uninfected egg, then the egg explodes. What it really means, you don't get proper development, because the first mitotic division doesn't lead anywhere. And you get essentially what it does is that the parental set of the paternal set of chromosomes is destroyed. And now in the case of haplodiploid insects, that has the interesting effect that you get a sex change again. I mean, that you transform. In this case, the same mechanism would have the effect of transforming a female into a male. But here we talk about diploid individuals. Mosquitoes are diploid. And if, on the other hand, the same manipulated sperm hits an egg with a Wolbachia being present, then somehow Wolbachia manages to disable the bomb. So it has a twofold effect, namely to manipulate, to modulate the sperm on the one hand, and to rescue the fertilized egg on the other hand.
What's the advantage of the bomb for Wolbachia? Yeah, because it's staying
there. Yeah, the important thing to say is the Wolbachia who produces the bomb itself has no advantage of it, because it cannot reproduce, so it doesn't open the possibility for that individual's reproduction or so. But what one must also say, and this is where the Cosmides and Tubi kind of view of the world comes into play, that because of the fact that it is already buried in the tomb there, I mean, it has nothing to lose. So whether it produces a bomb, even if it is a high, suppose that the Wolbachia, by producing the bomb, would risk her own life. it wouldn't matter because this bacterium hasn't got anything to lose. It is practically dead. It's acting from the grave, so to speak. And this is why spiteful behavior, normally the argument against spiteful behavior where you just harm others, although everybody else has the positive effect from it, that does normally not evolve, because if there's a cost involved, then you pay the cost and others have the benefit, and that doesn't work. But here it is different. And so in a sense, by this mechanism, what is done, if you assume that there's only one Wolbachia in the population, that is, we are talking about one genetic type of Wolbachia, then it is being nasty against those host females that do not carry the Wolbachia. And by being nasty to those hosts, you indirectly are friendly towards your sisters, if you like. Yes. Sure. That is another. Yeah, sure. You're right. I mean, you achieve two goals. You achieve the one goal is that you achieve is that those females that do not carry a Wolbachia are unsuccessful, and that also that the production of such females is reduced because of the effect you mentioned. Yes, that's true.
But the borderline between the Protestant part of Germany and the Catholic part of Germany, you would think you would have the argument moved very quickly.
Yeah, the thing is,
why hasn't it moved?
I think one should not think of these mosquito populations as one big population that is continuous or so. I mean, it's a long, think of lots of small local populations that are very loosely connected, and some of which are infected and others are not. That's
so these are island populations?
Yeah, yeah. It's a
geography.
Well, I mean, that's insect ecology. It's not true that they are just one big population over a continent or so. It's one way we learn about this by looking at these phenomena.
But from the chart you drew, because every time the infected person is made with the Catholic, it becomes the offspring are infected. Right?
Yes, actually, there is one study, one such invasion has been observed. There was in Drosophila, I think it was in Melanogaster even, there was a Californian Drosophila population where probably due to human intervention, not the scientists who did that, but since you bring in individuals, a ship comes from South America, brings in bananas or whatever, and maybe then there are Drosophila that are also imported and that carry the thing also. So for one reason or another, there was an infection taking place of a Californian population near Anaheim, near Disneyland. And then people actually were able to observe the spread of this population throughout California, which was extremely fast. So it's actually, if one can model this, and people have modeled this, the invasion of a population, and what you find in the model is that there's an initial invasion barrier. You have to have a certain fraction of the population already infected before it takes off, otherwise you die out. So there's an equilibrium if you which is unstable. If you are below that equilibrium, you go back to zero. If you are above in frequency, you go up. Not to 100% because you don't have 100% transmission rate. And clearly one question is how, if so many insect species are infected, I mean, how does that happen, that the initial barrier is overcome? That has worried the theoreticians quite a bit. And one argument is that these populations are not homogeneous populations, that you have little pockets that are loosely connected, and that in these very small pockets, it's easier to reach the starting frequency, or that due to random effects, you make it there locally, and then from then on you can spread like a phase transition. What people have not studied is the question of coevolution of host and the bacterium, and this is what we are working on, because I think what's nice about the idea of Leda Cosmides and John Tooby is that there is this evolutionary conflict in the genome which is so nicely demonstrated by all these actions of Wolbachia. But what is not so clear is why can Wolbachia get away with all this if this is against the interest of the rest of the host genome, except for mitochondrial genes, and there are only so few. So how come that so many species are infected, and that we know at least quite a number of cases where these nasty tricks are being done? And I must say that part of the story here is, and that may also apply to other cases of genetic parasites, to some extent the host becomes dependent on the parasite here for the following reason. If you are a female, actually the fact is that in some of the studies where one actually has the data, the female has a fecundity cost that is induced by Wolbachia, at least in the lab. So those who are infected lay fewer eggs as compared to the uninfected ones. Now, one would say that wouldn't it be nice for such a female to then simply develop some antibiotic effect and kill the bacterium, or maybe search for hot spots, sit on a hot rock where she survives but the bacterium get killed, also heat shock treatment or whatever. I mean, one could imagine a number of things in which ways actually you can, as an experimenter, you can do that. You put her into a sauna and that kills the bug. But so why does she not herself ask for entry to a sauna? And now the reason is that she's in a situation, I like to compare that with a protection money racketeer gang story. So suppose you are a shop owner in the center of Berlin. There's this man knocking at your door saying, very dangerous here. If you need protection, because otherwise your place will be set on fire. So, and then clearly the owner knows that this guy has friends who would be willing to do such a thing, and he gives voluntarily the money to the protection money racketeer because it's cheaper to pay them than to have the whole thing on fire. And this is exactly the situation in which the female is here, because if she pets her little Wolbachia instead of being nasty to them, then her eggs will be protected against all these manipulated sperm. She will have successful fertilizations. And so once the population is infected, the females are stuck with it in some sense. And that is one of the reasons perhaps why Wolbachia can get away with it.
Yes? Just an alternative. You know, the toll-like receptors it's a response to infection, to pathogenic infection. There are certain receptors that sense the bacteria and they can induce a lot of peptide compounds and so on, protecting against otherwise lethal infection. But is the possibility that the bug is a little bit infected by a bacteria that is not killing it? I wouldn't be surprised if it's more resistant to superinfection by another bacteria.
But I mean, Wolbachia has a long evolutionary history. Wolbachia has a long evolutionary history as an intracellular parasite, and they must have found ways to at least be safe with regard to the immune system of the host and all that.
Well, I wonder if they have found safe ways to tweak it a little bit, and so an additional advantage.
Yeah. But the other thing one has to say is that the immune system of insects clearly is different from our immune system, in the sense that they cannot say, here I have an infected cell, so I will just kill that cell. They are post-apoptotic or so, or whatever. And what that means is that it probably these intracellular parasites have an easier way to evolve in insects than they would have with us, because we would just say, okay, the cell is infected, let's kill the cell, and that's it. And, was that the famous last word? That's it.